Welcome to the Deeks.ai podcast, where Wake Forest innovators unpack the real-world magic of artificial intelligence through candid conversations. I'm Michael Ferrari.
I'm Ryan Scholl.
Please join us as we explore how artificial intelligence is transforming work across campus, one fascinating story at a time.
The U.S. patent system is built on a simple bargain. Disclose your invention to the public, and you receive a 20-year monopoly to profit from it. But what happens when the inventor isn't human? Wake Forest Law Professor Keith Robinson breaks down the fascinating legal battles happening right now at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. He even debates the ethical questions surrounding artificial intelligence in the justice system, like the possibility of an algorithm deciding your prison sentence. It would be a crime to miss this episode.
Here we are again at Deeks.ai, still the number one higher education artificial intelligence podcast at Wake Forest University. Today we are talking with Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Research at Wake Forest, Keith Robinson, specializes at the intersection of patent law and artificial intelligence, so highly relevant to what we're talking about today. As a background in electrical engineering from an ACC school we're not going to talk about, but he bridges the gap between complex technology, legal framework, focusing on how AI is reshaping innovation and the patent system. I believe both your degrees are from that school, so we won't mention it right now. But anyway, interesting two fields that we're going to get into. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And you can look me up to find out what that ACC school is that we won't mention.
It's a darker shade of blue. We'll go there. No hate for it. So I want you to introduce yourself, but I want you to talk a little bit about your background and specifically what you did before becoming a professor. You actually had some introduction to artificial intelligence before it hit the mainstream.
Sure. Yeah, so yeah, again, thank you for having me. So I took a circuitous path to law and academia. So I actually, after I graduated undergrad, I worked for a couple years as a consultant and then decided to go to law school. After I graduated from law school, I became a patent practitioner. So I worked for a law firm in DC for 7.5 years before switching into teaching. And I was in the electronics practice group there at the firm. So mainly we worked with clients that had inventions in the area of electronics, consumer products. But what was interesting, what's relevant to our conversation today, I did get a chance to work with a few clients that were startup clients, and their technology has relevance today to artificial intelligence. So some of the early patents projects that I worked on had to do with neural networks, had to do with machine learning. And so I got a little bit of early exposure to the technology then. Of course, this is in the early 2000s. We didn't really call it, artificial intelligence wasn't a buzzword like it is now. And so, but that's what we were doing. We were working on sort of the early foundational projects and patents that undergird this technology that is exploding today.
So you said previously that it wasn't called artificial intelligence, it was just all these different technologies that were coming together. So there were a lot of precursors. And so famously, one of the first chatbots was Eliza. Eliza walked so ChatGPT could run, right?
Right.
So you kind of saw some of it coming together. You had some early introduction. So that must have been interesting now when the public realized what this was, and you're probably like, hey guys, look, I've been working with this for a while.
Well, I think a lot of it is the theory behind the technology that we're seeing today has been around for a long time, right? So the theoretical model for a neural network, that was 1940s, yeah. Right? And so it's taken a while for some of the technology to catch up. Yeah, I talk to my students a lot about the importance of the explosion of the internet for the collection of data, right? So we get the explosion of data because we get the internet and everybody now is participating in the internet, uploading things. We're seeing the explosion of data. Also, you look at sort of the advances that we've made with respect to chips, processing chips, and that has also helped. So it was really a combination of the data being available, the processing power being available, that these applications could actually sort of be realized. And you know, the early applications like vision learning, name, you know, sound recognition, things of that nature, those sort of came online early. And then we've seen it just sort of progress and progress from there.
Interesting. So you have specialized in patents, in patent law, and patents now are incredibly clear world with artificial intelligence, correct? I mean, it's so easy to determine who deserves a patent, whether it's ChatGPT or the creator. No, seriously, it's a mess, right? It's an
It is a
absolute
mess,
mess.
yes.
Talk to us a little bit about how a patent works. And then why it's such a mess with artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so essentially a patent is it's a government bargain, right? And so what we say in the United States is we want inventors to disclose their inventions. We want them to be forthcoming with these new innovations that could benefit society. And so in the United States, what we say is if you disclose your invention, right, if you disclose your invention, then in exchange for that disclosure, we will give you a 20-year period where you can exclude anyone else from making, using, or selling your invention. That gives you 20 years to commercialize your invention and make money, right? The most common way that my students and most people encounter this system, right, is through the prescription drug system, right? And so when you go to the doctor and the doctor says, "Hey, this is the drug I want to prescribe to you," right? Usually it's a name brand drug, but occasionally he could say, "Look, I'll give you a prescription for the name brand drug, which is going to cost you $50, or you can get the generic, which is going to cost you $20," right? Why is there a generic available? Why is it so cheap? Because typically that patent on that drug has expired, right? And so now that compound is in the, you know, it is freely and publicly available for anyone that can is capable of making it, right? And so that is the bargain, right? Now, also in the United States, what's unique to the United States that might be different from other countries is that in the United States, we grant patents to individual inventors, right? It can be one or more people, but we grant patents to individuals, not companies, not entities.
So if a company produces something, it would be the individual inside of the company gets the patent,
Typically,
not
yes,
the.
right? So that there's some inventor, some person that is responsible. Now they might assign their rights to the invention to the company, but the name on the patent is that person, right? Or persons. And so what's been fascinating to watch in the US with respect to patent law and AI is, and we've already had a couple of cases about this, is where it's supposedly the AI is inventing, right? Or the AI has contributed to the invention, right? And so there was a case a couple years ago. A gentleman by the name of Stephen Thaler said, "I have a artificial intelligence system that has invented two patents," and he filed the patents on behalf of the artificial intelligence system. At the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, they said, "No, you can't get patents because we only grant patents to human inventors. We only grant patents to individuals." This went all the way up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which is right below the Supreme Court. And the Federal Circuit upheld the USPTO's ruling. They said, based on our law, based on the language of the statute, we can only grant patents to human inventors." And so Stephen Thaler's artificial intelligence system did not get to be the first artificial intelligence to be an inventor in the United States. Now the USPTO is dealing with the situation and trying to wrestle with the situation where, okay, we get that our artificial intelligence system in and of itself can't be an inventor, right? But what about if the artificial intelligence helped an inventor? What if it contributed to part of the invention, right? But not whole invention, right? So how do we deal with that? And so we've had, in the last year and a half, we had the USPTO come out with guidance sort of on both sides of the issue. And this is a huge issue right now that we're dealing with, is trying to figure out how do we deal with quote unquote AI assisted patents.
So if I wanted to invent something and I use my favorite AI and I type in my prompt, I mean, to make this really simple, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, type in a prompt, hit the enter key, comes out, I find this cool invention, I submit the patent. I didn't do anything. I wrote a prompt, I hit it. Can I now be the holder of that patent?
Based
Even though
on,
I didn't do anything?
Yeah, based on the laws that currently stands, my answer to that would be no, right? My answer to that would be no. Now, where it gets murky is, let's say that whatever the AI came up with, you said, I don't like that, that doesn't quite work. Mm-hmm. Let's try to do it a different way, right? And so you are now working alongside the AI, right? So the AI and you are going back and forth,
okay,
right? And so eventually what you produce is a collaboration. It's not one-sided,
yep.
Right? That's the issue, right? That is where the law right now, we don't know how to deal with it explicitly.
So under the current law, if that patent is submitted, who gets it?
That's the question, right? We don't know, right? And so if you are fully forthcoming and say, look, the AI helped me and, you know, did X, Y, and Z, and I did A, B, and C, that's a different story than if you just said, yeah, I invented it. Yeah, the AI helped, but I invented it. AI was just a tool, right?
So what if I say, if the AI helped me, but I don't disclose that, and I just say, I did it by myself, do I then get it?
Based on the current law right now, I would say yes. Right now, is that, are you being forthcoming? Are
exactly.
you being truthful? Because you do have to sign an oath and declaration that says you're the inventor. So it could make your patent vulnerable on the other side.
Okay, so that could be challenged.
It could be challenged. But the thing is, we just don't know, right? And so
this is all up in the court system.
It's all up in the court system waiting to be litigated. So it's a very exciting time to be in AI and in the IP world.
I mean, if you pay attention to the AI news, there's a case every day about this. And
yes.
Once this gets settled, we're going to have you back so you can explain.
I'd be happy to.
You know, how this all shook out.
I'd be happy to.
Now, I want to make an interesting pivot, which kind of has ties to this. I want to talk about AI governance and regulation. Obviously, China and U.S. are two major players in this, and they take very different views of this. But so the U.S. right now is wrestling a lot with all kinds of AI regulations. The White House is putting out statements and guidelines very loose about federal policy, and states are going and trying to put protective policies, preemptive policies. But, I mean, it's an absolute patchwork. You know, Colorado has something now. Idaho has something. New York, Washington, Oregon, Tennessee. How are these AI companies supposed to deal with this patchwork versus very loose federal guidelines?
Yeah. Well, sort of facetiously, I'll say the AI companies should hire good lawyers, right? Because you're right. You're absolutely
right.
Can't
we just use AI to be our lawyers?
I wouldn't recommend that, but we can talk about that in a moment.
Yeah,
but
we'll get there.
Yeah. But it is a patchwork system. And so the most recent guidance coming out of the federal government, they did release sort of a framework for AI regulation. And the bottom line there from reading that framework was that they would prefer not to have this patchwork of state regulation, and they would prefer for Congress to come up with some federal guidance, federal governance over artificial intelligence. Now, if you've been paying attention to the news lately, what's going on in D.C., I don't have a lot of confidence that that's something that our Congress is going to be able to do anytime soon.
This administration seems more on the acceleration side of it. And the statement is we have to combat China because if we regulate too much, China, who will not regulate, will just go so far ahead.
Yeah, so the theory this administration is following is that less regulation is good for the advancement and development of the technology. Okay. And so that is not a, you know, that's a great theory. That theory has been proven out in certain circumstances.
There's a but coming. I can tell. Yep.
But at the same time, we've already seen in this country the harms that can come to bear if we let a industry, if we let a technology percolate without any regulation, right? And there I'm referring to sort of social media. And
what a failed experiment.
and things that have gone on in that industry, where now we are trying to put the genie back in the bottle with respect to some of the harms that we are seeing impact, you know, young people with regards to social media. Right. So I think that we have to have a balanced approach. Now, what I will say about this administration is in the framework that they release, they did talk about the need for AI governance with respect to protection of children, protection of minors, right? So I think there is a acknowledgement there that for our most vulnerable population, we do need to put in place some guardrails to make sure that they are protected from any harms that could come to them from using this technology.
What is your opinion? What kind of regulations and guardrails do we need? And do we need it at the federal or the state level?
So I think that the, you know, if you look at some of the state regulations, we can learn a lot from some of those state regulations. And I think if you look at the Colorado AI Act specifically, the Colorado AI Act, in a way, it mirrors some of the things that they are doing in Europe with the EU AI Act, mm-hmm. which is already been implemented. And one of those is to identify the primary sectors where AI can be most harmful, right? Or that we want to make sure that we keep an eye on. So one of those is, for example, healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. The use of AI in making healthcare decisions, the use of AI in making financial decisions with respect to you know, lending and banking, right? The use of AI with respect to making housing decisions. The things that the applications where we are impacting people's lives directly, where we would hope that there would be a human decision maker or a human mm-hmm. in the loop, those are the areas that I think some of these state laws are trying to look at and make sure that we regulate carefully. Even Florida, you know, Florida has a law on the books with respect to using AI in political ads, mm-hmm. right? And so these states are recognizing that AI used in a wrong situation or a dangerous situation could cause greater harm to society mm-hmm. and the population. So there, you know, I think states are sort of picking their battles, picking and choosing. Colorado is by far the most comprehensive, but if you look at other states like Utah, for example, they are looking at regulating, you know, if you are someone that provides professional service, like you're an accountant, right? You have to disclose to your clients whether or not you're using AI, right? So I think states are picking and choosing areas where they see AI could be harmful, more harmful than it is beneficial, and they are seeking to regulate those. I would love for the U.S. to have a federal AI governance framework. I just don't think it's realistic.
It's got to be so tough for the AI companies, though, having to deal with 50 different, you know, regulations. I want to bring Michael in on this because Michael and I have talked about regulations before. And Keith, while you talked more about some of the decisions and the harmful things, I know Michael's talked more about creators' rights mm-hmm. and some of those regulations. Michael, what kind of regulations do you think there should be around, you know, I mean, you've talked a lot about music and video and stuff like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky to really come to like a specific answer in regards to like what I think they should do. In terms of regulation, and then obviously, talking about things like copyright. But like, the more I think about it, I still stick with it's hard for me to separate completely what AI does versus what humans do. Whereas, you have the clear-cut examples of, say, Vanilla Ice versus like Queen and David Bowie with him, copying that song pretty much note for note for, most of it. Versus, how many times have we read a book or seen a movie where the bomb stops at one, or the character you thought was dead shows up at the last second? So, like, from the creative aspect, it's kind of like humans are always taking inspiration and stuff from one another. And so, if AI is doing it, I'm kind of like, who are we to judge what's too much, if that makes sense? I kind of lean more towards, I guess I would say my opinion on the regulation really just comes down to what do the people really want. And some communities are speaking out about that, specifically in regards to data centers. And I'm thinking that that will guide the
Oh,
convo
you just
quite a
opened up a
bit.
whole nother can of worms right there. I did
I
not
mean,
think Vanilla Ice would be mentioned in this
I
Oh, we go everywhere. We go everywhere. Yeah, I mean, we can debate Under Pressure versus Ice Ice Baby as long as you want, but let's talk about how AI is being used in the practice of law. You were talking about just even scratching the surface. How are anything from junior lawyer, paralegals and junior lawyers up to seasoned lawyers using it?
So I think in the practice of law, what we've seen is a proliferation of legal tools that have embedded AI or have been built from the ground up with artificial intelligence in them, promising that they will make lawyers more efficient. They will help with their research, things of that nature, right? And so, what we've seen in the practice of law, right, is we've seen lawyers starting to use those tools, and it's almost in the news every day. Sadly, we've seen lawyers get in trouble for using these tools in the wrong way as well, right? Sort of c cutting corners,
Inventing legal cases.
inventing legal cases out of thin air, et cetera, right? And so, one of the things you gotta understand, especially with these large language models, about the practice of law is it's almost 80 to 90% writing, right? And so now you have a large language model that will just churn out text for you, right? And so the temptation is to use these large language models to just churn out text, right? And that's going to save the lawyer time, save the client money, et cetera, right? I think the best and smartest application we're seeing of these legal tools is actually as a double check, right? And that is to say that a lawyer will write something or craft a draft or provide sort of a theory to the AI and ask the AI, hey, poke holes in my theory. Help me find some cases that might be relevant to this point that I want to make. And for the lawyer-specific tools and applications, their promises that they won't hallucinate because they are drawing upon a database of cases that have already been checked, that we know that they exist, et cetera, right? There still are some problems with those tools, but all the law firms that are using AI and that are saying that they're using AI, what I've seen is sort of a broad policy is that they say, look, nothing is going to come out of our firm that has not been reviewed by a human, right? Everything has to be human reviewed. But absolutely, I think law firms are using artificial intelligence to help with this work. And I think the idea is that for lawyers, they can actually do more work if they use AI and use it appropriately.
So I'm going to lead you down a path here. You just said that a large percentage of this legal work is writing, which AI is getting better and better at. Is that a good use of humans' time when this other intelligence can do that? Where if this other intelligence takes over the writing, can the law professional spend more time with their clients and form that relationship? Because I know context is key and the better legal teams, better lawyers, know their clients, know things about them. Is that a better use of the human time?
That's a great question. So what I would say to that is, I think it depends on the writing, right? So if I were to tell you, so Ryan, I am going to this the motion that I'm going to write in your case, I'm defending you. The motion I'm going to write in your case is going to decide whether or not you go to jail for 25 years or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to, I want to spend more time with you. So I'm just going to let the AI write it. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to file that versus, do you want me, a seasoned lawyer, to actually write the draft? I think what you would prefer is that you would have me write the draft and maybe spend a little bit less time with you in that instance. And so what I would say is, I think that for high stakes writing, where it really matters, right, where this is sort of the case in a nutshell, mm-hmm. we still want our lawyers to be the point person for that, right? If it's like sending a couple emails out, some internal writing, if AI is sort of being the main driver of those communications, I think that's a good use, because I can't even imagine how much time lawyers take now to just sort of answer emails during a day, right? When they could be actually doing the legal work.
I've seen some legal bills and how much they charge for that. So yeah. I know.
So imagine if we get rid of sort of that back and forth busy work, right? And we just allow the lawyers to focus on writing the things that matter, right? And, you know, using AI to help them write those things, mm-hmm. but not relying on it 100%. That's the best vision I can see for law practice right now, based on where, you know, the progress that AI has made with respect to writing.
Now, do you think maybe the lawyers who would go that route of just saving the time and cutting corners, do you think they would have done that anyway? Like, do you think that just kind of speaks to the quality of them as a lawyer, and less so an indictment on AI itself?
That's a great point. I think it's true, right? It's like, you know, the saying that, you know, money will reveal all. So, you know, you get a lot of money and then you start acting like a jerk, right? So, you know, these lawyers, you know, some of them are under a lot of time pressure, a lot of, you know, just a lot of strain. And so maybe it was a moment of weakness, you know, at least the ones that we hear about, a moment of weakness where they said, you know, no one's going to find out this is, you know, I think I've put in a good enough prompt where I won't get any hallucinations, and they have failed at their task. But, you know, the law, practicing the law is hard. It's time consuming. That's why lawyers bill for their time. And so I think it is the nature of the practice of law is one that, you know, these little mistakes matter. And so it's really up to the lawyer to make sure that they are turning in something that they have double checked, that they have vetted.
Now I'm curious, if you know, is that opening the door to any issues on behalf of the client, where like they have like a proper recourse if they do end up with representation that's just plugging stuff into ChatGPT and representing them poorly? Or are they just kind of, you know, hung out to dry, I guess?
No, I would imagine, I haven't seen any sort of egregious cases where the client has been able to say, my lawyer is not representing me appropriately because they're just sort of plugging everything into ChatGPT. But I would imagine, you know, once a lawyer sort of has been outed as sort of using these tools for their work instead of actually doing the work themselves, I think people are very, you know, legal representation is not cheap. And so I think people will make sure that they speak with their pocketbook and say, look, I'll go elsewhere for my legal services if all that you're going to do is just sort of plug my information into one of these tools and just use whatever is spit out in representing me.
Gotcha.
Our listener is going to have to get comfy for this next topic, because this is one I'm kind of excited to hear your opinion about. And I have to do a little setup. And I'm going to make an analogy here. And I want to talk about judges and juries and impartial. Let's make the analogy to sports and impartiality, that we are living in a time now where sports are making this pivot to integrating more technology. Now, we've talked about this before. Baseball right now is using ABS, and CB Buckner's having an awful year. And thank goodness this didn't exist when Angel Hernandez was there. In football, we had the Fail Mary in the Packers game. Famously, we had the hand of God in soccer. Jim Joyce ruined Armando Galarraga's perfect game. Tennis has had Hawkeye for a while. Football has instant replay. Soccer has VAR. And the most famous thing was last fall, Wake Forest versus Georgia Tech. A missed offsides call cost us the game. So all of these examples in sports had to do with human fallacy and officials. And the traditionalists have always argued, well, human fallacy is part of the game. And that's great if you're on the winning side. But if you're on the losing side of that call, you're like, well, I just want it to be right. But for hundreds of years, a tenth of an inch in a strike zone has always been, well, it's part of the human. The umpire is part of the game. But do we want everything to be completely objective and completely the same? In sports, maybe yes. And that's why in tennis, the Hawkeye system, you basically get the exact call every single time. You're going to get the right call. In the judicial system, do we want completely objective robot judges making these calls? Is there any subjective or any way for the judges to have leniency on certain people or take in different circumstances? I that's a whole big lead up,
right?
And I have no idea how you're going to answer this question, but where do we see this going, and will people ever accept
if I could just throw one wrench in there? I was watching a football game last season, and then now they have that like confirmed like first down or not. It must be a chip in the football or something. Yeah. Saw in real time happen where that confirmed the first down, and then they were like, actually, no, it was wrong. So just throwing that little wrench in. Now we have to assume that the technology is always right.
So we took the detour, we made the analogy, but I think it's a really good analogy for judges, juries.
So let me start answering your question here, right? So what is it that mathematical models and AI are good at, right? And what we know that they are good at, what they've proven that they are good at, is working in a confined system where we know all the rules and we know all the conditions, right? So if you think about the first AI systems that were trained to learn how to play checkers and then chess and then the game of Go, right? Really good at sort of these closed environments where we know all the boundaries, right? And that's why I think that these AI systems that are being used in sports have been so effective, because we know what the strike zone is, right? Now we can modify the strike zone a little bit for each batter, right? We believe it's fair. We've seen it tested, right? We know that 10 yards is, you need 10 yards to get a first down. We know that there's a chip in the football that's going to tell us, under that pile of football players where the ball is, right? And so in those confined systems where we have set rules, AI is really good, and we've seen it be effective, right? You know, I watch baseball highlights every day when I get home just to relax, and you see sort of when you think the ball is a, you know, you think a pitch is a ball, and it just gets the edge of that strike zone, and it's a strike. It's great. It's amazing. Now we go over to law, right? There are some cases that you have the same situation where it's pretty cut and dry, right? The speed limit in this area was 45. You were going 75, right? Very cut and dry. We have our boundary conditions. It's a open and shut case, as they say, right? But that's not really where the stakes are, right? The stakes are in law where there are gray areas. And I tell my students all the time, you want to embrace the gray areas because that's where lawyers are needed. Mm-hmm. That's where lawyers need to come in and play a role. That's where persuading humans, other humans, that your client is guilty or innocent, or persuading a panel of judges that your client has the better argument really works, right? And where there are gray areas, where there are boundary conditions, I just don't think AI right now, as it's constituted right now, is the right tool to use to make those decisions as a, you know, AI or a robot judge, right? That's where we still need human judgment. And that's where, you know, that's why I tell my students all the time, look, you are going to have a job so long as you know how to advocate on behalf of your client, right? And be able to live in these gray areas, dissect the issues, and make a cogent argument on behalf of your client, right? So that's how I would answer that question. I think AI is great in some areas, but in most areas of the law where it really matters, where things are on the line, I really am skeptical that we could ever see an AI judge making a decision that people would be accepting of.
Now, so there are some South American countries right now that are experimenting with AI judges, and I've heard about this, but I'm not in depth, so I don't know really how that's going. But I know that they are doing experiments. Do you think that is a way to alleviate some of the pressure on the court system with some of those cut and dry cases you're talking about? Is there a way to segment the cases, and will the American public ever accept it?
Right. Yeah. So. Absolutely. So there, I'm not saying that I don't think that AI has any role, right? And so if there are sort of those cut and dry cases where there's not any gray area, there's not any room for argument, right? I think that AI could be used to be way more efficient, right? I just think we have to be careful. Even if we're using AI, I do think I would feel comfortable if there was just a human sort of checking to make sure, okay, on this case, this is what the AI decided. This is why I decided it. Doesn't look like there are any outside facts that would change that answer. Fine. And, you know, have a human just sort of review and rubber stamp the AI's decision. Is that more efficient? Absolutely. Because our courts are overrun. Our courts are overcrowded. And so I think these countries that are experimenting with this and using it are using it for efficiency reasons, right? Would I feel comfortable having AI determine whether or not someone serves time in prison or not? Absolutely not, right? Despite all the human bias that can be involved with having a judge, I think right now, I would rather have that human judge in the seat presiding over that case. I would rather have a human jury there deciding innocence or guilt rather than an artificial intelligence system.
I think it's a really interesting debate, though, because you talk about the objectivity versus subjectivity. There have been studies, and you know, talked about this, about do you want to get the judge just before lunch when he's hungry, you know, how many whiskeys did he have at the judge's poker game the night before? You know, what was his golf score in the morning and you have him in the afternoon? Or, you know, did he have a really good morning? And, you know, so that human subjectivity does play a huge part, and it could go in a defendant's favor or against them, depending on the case, where the robot judge, and I'm throwing up my air quotes,
yeah,
could be completely objective, and is that more blind justice or not? And I mean, clearly you've stated the case, but I think that is a debate that we will be watching for a while.
Oh, 100%. And I think that there are everything that you said, right, are, you know, have been documented reasons why judges might make a decision that we disagree with or we don't like, right? And, you know, then on top of that, we have the own biases that the judge might actually bring with them into the courtroom. And there are numerous examples of that impacting cases as well, right? But, you know, we've seen the same with respect to AI systems. AI systems, depending on the data that they are trained on, depending upon the code that they are given, they carry with them their own biases, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is something that we are going to live with, whether it be a human or an AI system. The question is, what level of bias, what level of outside factors are we as a community willing to live with and willing to accept, right? There's always going to be some margin of error. What margin of error are we going to be willing to live with?
All right, enough lead up. You're actually a professor.
Yes.
let's now get into education.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk a little bit about how you use artificial intelligence with your class, not only in the classroom. I want to hear about some assignments, but your preparation for classes as well.
Yeah, so I've experimented with artificial intelligence in the classroom in a lot of different ways. So I think the first thing and primary thing is I want my students to be exposed to artificial intelligence. So in most of my classes, except for my first year class, I make sure that some of the assignments they can use artificial intelligence on. You know, I'm agnostic as to what tools most of the time. But the idea is to expose them to the technology in a legal setting so that they can see what the technology does well, what the technology doesn't do so well. Mm-hmm. So they're exposed to it. They're exposed to it quite early on. In one of my classes, it's a designing legal apps class. There, we teach lawyers about how to design legal applications. So applications that will help a user solve a legal issue or help another lawyer work through or solve a legal issue. And this past fall, when I taught the class, one of the assignments is for the students to use the artificial intelligence to create a client persona that they then have to interview, right? And the idea here is to help the students simulate interviewing a client, right? And so you build that persona. Oh, the client is 35 years old. Client is a single mom. Client just received an eviction notice. Client also had a bad day at work where she was reprimanded, and now she is coming to you, sitting down with you to talk about her her landlord-tenant case, right? And so the students have to walk through and interview the client, and I think that has been interesting because if we get the persona right, it gives the students a good example of what it might be like to interview a client on a bad day, when they may not be as forthcoming with information or they may be short with them. And you still have to, if you're representing that client, you still have to do your best to represent that client and do your job to get the information that you need to represent them. So that's one of the many ways that we're using AI in the classroom to help our students in the practice of law.
Have you used it for, say, here's a judge that had a bad day, you know, present your case to them by any chance?
I personally have not used it for that. I think that would be a good example, but I will tell you what I have used it for is I've given a large language model an outline of a lecture that I plan to give that day. And I'll ask the large language model, is there anything I'm missing? What part of this subject might trip students up the most, right? And it gives me Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong, but I always sort of get an idea of maybe one way in which I can tweak my lecture, one point that I might want to take a little bit longer time on explaining that to me. You know, I've been doing this for, you know, over a decade, and so for me, a lot of things might come second nature, but the large language model might flag something that say, no, this is something that students might get tripped up on, so you might want to take a little bit more time. So that's one way I've been using it in the classroom to help me.
I'm curious too. We've had some, we recently started speaking to students, and we've had some students mention like using it, like using artificial intelligence as like a first pass for grading and all that. I'm just curious what your reaction would be if you found out a student had made more or less an AI equivalent of you to then feed their, you know, assignments and projects into, to kind of get like a first pass from you, you know, more or less.
Yeah, I would say good for them. I mean, I think that obviously maybe the AI is correct. I've never done that. I've never asked AI to grade something in the way that I would. But I think what that gives a student is it gives them some feedback on their work, right? And I think that's one of the things that I think is beneficial about these tools is before we would write something in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to get feedback, if you wanted to, you know, say you're writing a sensitive email to someone, you want to get feedback on that email or double check to see if the tone is right, you might send it to another person to get that feedback. Now, you could do a quick check with AI, you know, still send it to that person if you wanted to, but you could run that email by AI and AI will give you feedback. Now, it's up to you to decide whether to implement it or not. But I do think it's tremendously helpful in that way.
Cool.
You started the education part by saying you don't use artificial intelligence in your first year class. Mm. Why not?
Yeah, so there are a number of reasons. So I think when after ChatGPT got introduced and about a year's time when people saw, okay, this thing is sticking around, this is not a fad, and now kids are using it for homework, you started to see a lot of articles resurface about how there was the same panic, you know, in the, you know, the 1950s, 1960s about the calculator, right? And so the idea there was, should we let students use a calculator in math, right? And are they not able to think? Well, what we do now is, right, if, you know, I have a senior in high school, but when he started doing math, like K through like fifth grade, he didn't use a calculator. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, let's teach you how to solve problems. Let's teach you how, you know, the basic skills you'll need in life, right, to do some math in your head. And then middle school, high school, when you're doing more complex problems, more complex research, then the calculator got introduced. And so I like that model, and that's the model that I've used in my classes. So my first year students, they're just starting out. I want them to learn how to think like lawyers. I want them to learn the basics. And, you know, next year they will be using AI. But at least for that first year or the time that they're in class with me, I want it to be a AI free experience so that we can really drill down and work on the fundamentals.
I think that's a common theme we hear from a lot of professors, that you want to build the foundational skills, you know, through every discipline, build those foundational skills, then layer AI on top of that to go to higher levels once you have that basic foundation.
Correct.
Yeah, so we hear that a lot. And the other favorite term now is that cognitive struggle, that learning, you have to struggle to learn, where getting the answer is not the point. It's the, right, the process, the journey you take to get that answer. And I think that's what you're talking about, how to be that lawyer, how to learn to communicate with your client, how to read legal texts and explain that. And so you need that practice and you need those basic skills.
Correct.
Yeah. Do you see certain ways that your students may be using AI that have surprised you potentially?
Well, so what I'll say with respect to law students, and this is going to sound a little stereotypical, but law students tend to be rule followers, mm-hmm. and they also tend to be, to some extent, technology adverse. Now, that's not all, but that is what I've seen. And so I've even overheard conversations of law students that are negative or down on using AI for those reasons, right? To say, look, no, we're here to think, we're here to learn. And so we want to not use AI. That said, right, I have seen some amazing uses of AI by students to collect data, to make sense of data, to visualize data or to visualize things that, you know, charts, tables, graphs, things of that nature, you know, where a picture is worth a thousand words, right? And 100% it is. And you might not have the skills or tools to be able to draw, but you give AI this information and it's able to visualize it for you. So I think law students, what I've observed is law students are using it in really interesting ways to help them understand the material better, which I'm very happy about.
Okay, we're going to wrap up now.
Okay.
With the final question.
Okay.
You have 2 degrees, correct?
Correct.
You have an engineering degree?
Yes.
And a law degree?
Correct.
Those are 2 professions that artificial intelligence is revolutionizing.
Yes.
What is it about you? Is AI just coming for you? No, sorry. That's not the real question. I would say that with the younger students, maybe early college or high school, who want to enter the law profession, knowing that artificial intelligence is changing most things in life now, and especially these professions, how would you advise them to integrate their skill set and their thought process with AI in the law?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, well, first I would say you have to learn how to write. You have to learn how to be persuasive with the written word if you want to be a successful practicing lawyer. What I would also say is those students have to be much more nimble because things could change now on a dime. And so whereas before the traditional path was I'll go to law school for 3 years, I'll do really well. A large law firm will hire me and I'll stay at that law firm, make partner and practice there for 35 years, retire with a gold watch and then go live in my boathouse. Right. Mm-hmm. That I think is not going to be the case for most of our students. Right. Most of our students are going to change jobs several times. They are going to have to be more entrepreneurial in their path. They're going to have to figure out what people are willing to pay for and learn how to do it. And you know what that is are going to be sort of these higher level tasks that require human communication, that require the building of relationships. They're going to require the understanding of complex human dynamics, right? And those are the skills that our students need to work on, right? So learn how to talk to people, learn how to communicate with people, learn how to persuade people, learn how people work. I think that's going to be more important than ever in the next 5 to 10 years.
Wake Forest Law Professor Keith Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks again to our guest, and thanks for listening to the Deeks.ai podcast. Please continue to follow the AI discussion by subscribing on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. If you have any comments, questions, or would like to join the discussion, please email us at deeks.ai@wfu.edu.